I think like the simple heuristic for us is like, you don't want someone to not get access to your banking product because their phone doesn't support it. We're talking about a population for which our banking bundle is getting them out of the cash economy and into the digital economy. They probably don't care deeply about like amazing animations or really cool like haptic feedback. We'll build those things, but like the first and most important responsibility is helping them make that transition.
Hi, I'm Eden Fulgo, and you're listening to How It's Tested, a monthly series where we discuss great products, how they're tested, and other stories from the testing community, featuring interviews with tech leaders, founders, testing experts, and creators. How It's Tested is brought to you by Heavybit, the leading investor in developer-first startups. For more information, visit heavybit.com. If you're interested in being a guest on this show, or if you would like to suggest a topic, find us on Twitter at Team Mobot. That's TEAMMOBOT. On today's episode, I'm speaking with Devin Cintron, an engineering leader at Komoon, a fintech startup. Hey, Devin, thanks so much for joining me on the How It's Tested podcast.
Yeah, super excited. I've been looking forward to this.
Just so everyone has a good sense of who you are and also the startup that you're working on right now, I would love for you to give an intro about yourself.
This is fun for me because I recently turned 27, so I'm now old enough where I feel like I have a career story to share. It's a funny age for a couple of reasons. First is there's this like 27 club thing. So if you like Google around, there's all these celebrities that died at this age, which is obviously quite a bit scary. I've also now been out of college like longer than the duration of college. So I'm starting to feel, you know, a little bit older. Because for a long time, you could feel like, okay, I just graduated. My story is interesting. I've been working at Komoon for 2.5 years now, which for me is actually a long duration. And we can get into the specifics of what we're building here in a minute. The only consistent thematic thread for my career prior to here is pretty much consistency around consumer fintech. I did quite a few things. In school, I studied computer science, so did kind of like the software internship thing to kick off. I ended up doing some bigger internships at like kind of the FAANG companies and a little bit earlier stage kind of startups, just coming around to like the unicorn level. That was early stuff for me, but after that, I did a few things that are consistent with fintech prior to working here. Right around the time I was graduating from school, we had COVID. So everyone kind of left campus. I was able to not do my last semester because I had accumulated enough credits. So I started a student lending company with somebody I'd met through my school. I worked on that for like 3 or 6 months. I think it was almost half a year before ultimately determining that for me at that point in time, I wasn't quite ready to build that kind of experience. I remember like the first, I was the technical co-founder in this relationship. And I remember the first day we like sat down to kind of build towards an MVP, which was going to be like allowing alumni to kind of lend to students of their alma mater. I remember I scoped out an MVP where I said, okay, I'll spend one day on the front end, one day on the back end, and one day on like the payment infrastructure. And that should be sufficient to get things going. So wasn't quite there at that point in time. After about half a year of that, I gave my equity back to my co-founder. I think I sold it to him for like $100 or $200 or something just to make it super official because it wasn't right the thing for me to pursue at the time. He's actually still working on it. They pivoted into a much better business and doing pretty well in the city. And then I kind of found myself in this interesting position where, you know, I liked tech, but the things I had done prior didn't really work for me. I had done like the big tech internship and found it to be a little sleepy, like great mentors, great team, but maybe not the right point in time for me. I had done a bit of a bigger startup. I was an intern at Cameo, the like celebrity one during COVID, actually alongside while I was building this other startup. So it was like the hottest time for that kind of market because all the celebrities were not able to work. Like they weren't doing new films. They weren't doing new TV production. So they were just growing like crazy.
I remember that.
So they became a unicorn while I was there as a summer intern, which is like a really bizarre experience because then you're like, whoa, this is easy. It's super easy to become a $1 billion company because I'm an intern and this is happening. So when you're like N=2, that can seem super, super attainable. I actually won the hot dog eating contest that summer there. So like that was my positive experience. I kind of had the interns doing some fun stuff while we were all remote.
That's amazing.
All this transpires. I came to the end of that experience and kind of the venture that wasn't for me And in school, I had this bad habit of like not knowing exactly what I wanted to do. So I tended to just kind of look at the peers around me and kind of use their interests as a compass for what makes sense to do. So like I did the big tech internship because that seemed to be a popular thing to do. Worked really hard on it, got it, and it turned out not to be a great fit. I didn't learn from that mistake. So like in my senior year of school, I then oriented around, okay, what else is this? What else is everyone pointing at? Okay, so there's this consulting thing. Like they have cool water bottles and like all the career fair tables are super popular. So I ended up pursuing that. And after that Cameo internship, after the venture, I worked a year at Bain, a big consulting company doing like slides and Excel sheets. But there, like the lending company, I did get to work on some fintech projects that I found pretty interesting. And like that early in your career, you can start to like build an internal monologue and definition of yourself where it's like, oh, okay, like my career is fintech. I mean, it's been like 18 months since I graduated school. So it's not that meaningful of one thus far, but that started becoming like a thematic consistency for me. After about a year at Bain, that also too, you know, didn't feel like the right fit. I got into that thinking it was going to be like the right kind of background for entrepreneurship and solving problems. Figured I have, you know, I got the technical side kind of figured out from undergrad. Maybe this will round me out. I think that career is like really solid, especially when you go in longer and you start solving more meaningful problems. But the like post-undergrad role is a lot of slide and like Excel sheet stuff, which I started to think probably wasn't the perfect background for building. So I went and worked actually in a product role for about 1 year. After that, I worked at a company called Caribou, which was doing I think they are still doing this. It was auto refinancing. And this was like peak ZERP, like zero interest rate period. So like refinancing made a ton of sense. Like any loan you had, you should be refinancing. So same thing happened. No eating contest this time, but we did become a unicorn while I was working there for my brief stint. So now I'm like, I've worked at like four places, half of which became a unicorn while I was working there. So I'm starting to think
You have the magic touch.
Yeah. No, I mean, this is probably something I should feature more distinctly in my resume. But year into that, I started talking to the Commune team who had just, you know, kind of incorporated and started thinking through what they wanted to build. I think the first conversation I had with Abiel, I completely misunderstood what he was working on. And just like with where I was at in time and what problems I was working on, I think I concluded, oh, he's like exclusively doing like underwriting for consumer loans for immigrants, which we'll talk more about our business is just not at all like the core focus. But then I had a second conversation and I started to understand what the team's working on here. And like the TLDR is like consumer mobile banking for Latinos who are living in the US, you know, as immigrants or people who have a tie to Latam living in the US. And we'll go into more detail on our business in a moment. But that started getting me really excited. My family's interesting. My mom is, you know, American. She's actually from West Virginia and my dad's from Puerto Rico. So I don't know how many people there are with that background. I think that's relatively rare of the West Virginia and Puerto Rican pair, but that does build for me some affinity with, you know, LATAM and Latin America overall. So I got really excited about the problem Commune was tackling and I talked to the team more, did the interviewing and then joined as a software engineer, I think like 3 or so months after things first got started. So like very much pre-product. The code base had a few commits, but we were really on the kind of early stages of things. It's now been 2.5 years. Right now, I'm an engineering manager here. I work on our mobile team. It's been an amazing experience. And I'll get now into like not TLDR, but a little bit longer and more detail into what Commune is. We're a consumer mobile bank for Latinos who live in the US, so like checking, account, debit card, transitioning people out of the, you know, unbanked economy into the digital economy with a banking bundle. We have also in-app the ability to send money back home. So if we take a big step back, the best way to think through this is like looking at what's the experience with the incumbents. So how's our banking bundle different from them? If you go to like chase.com/espanol, you'll find a website that has like some Spanish, but then if you print it out and you take like a red pen, you can start drawing circles around all the English copy. If you go through their application flow, for most of these banks, you'll find that there is no Spanish equivalent. It's English only. And then if you try to talk to customer support, you're going to find somebody speaking English where you have to wait a really long duration to get Spanish. Beyond that, if you don't have a social security number, it's going to be damn near impossible to get approved. And these businesses that have a brick and mortar footprint tend to have mechanisms built in to try to drive their customers to be more upmarket. So that might look like overdraft fees, for example. But basically, if you're Spanish speaking, if you don't have a social security number, and if you're not going to maintain like a really big deposit account, if you're not at a higher income level, it's going to be a painful experience, even if you can get an account. That's just the main primary banking experience. For our population, there's also obviously like the high degree of need for international transfers. We're talking about people who have like come from Mexico or living in the US, have their family back home, been here for a couple of years. Super important transaction for them is sending money back home, right? If you and I meet up today and we go to Queens, we could find like a million money transfer services. Every single one of them is going to be extraordinarily expensive. And this is kind of the marketplace for this population, extremely predatory. So if you are like a medium average person sending money back home, it's completely expected that you could be eating like $1,200, $1,300 per year in fees for these international transfers. Super expensive. One other example, if you're doing like check cashing, I talked to women who are working in the US on like agricultural visas through the H-2A agricultural program. So that's like someone from who lives primarily in Mexico, comes to the US for several months a year to do agricultural job and then goes back home, comes back and forth for some period of time. They get paid in checks, right? If they want to go to a check cashing service in the US, I've talked to folks who basically each time they do that, every pay cycle, so every 2 weeks, they take a bus, which is probably like $4 or $5. They go to a check cashing location, which in a lot of these less urban areas can be like pretty monopolistic. Those can cost as much as like $30 per check. And that's like per pay cycle.
That's a lot.
So that's like easily $600, $700 a year, right? So you have like, we'll just call it like 1,300 international transfers. We'll talk about like 700 for check cashing. You're now talking about like $2,000 per year just for like the bare minimum financial movement that you need to do for your day-to-day life. That's a lot of money for a population, especially that might be living paycheck to paycheck that's trying to build a better life for their family back home. So where does Komoon enter all of this? What we're building towards is helping these people and their families on their journey through upwards mobility. If we get to the high number, high level, like numerical stuff, I think that can be a good lens. We have 24/7 customer support in Spanish. That's across phone, email, and app messaging, WhatsApp. Our app is entirely, obviously, in Spanish as well. We support 100 plus ID types from Latin America. So if you have a voter ID from El Salvador, if you have a driver's license from Guatemala, if you have a document called like a matricula consular from Mexico, or you have a passport from Venezuela, like any one of these documents, we can get you an account. We have 90,000 locations to deposit cash in the US, and that number is always increasing. And then our fee for international transfers is typically like $2.99. This month, actually, if you have a transaction bigger than $300, it's $0.99. And that's compared to these money transfer services where it can be like $10 plus pretty commonly. Those are the numbers. But if we look at like the individual experience, and I can like draw together and, you know, an example, I think that can kind of give a more personal image of what it's like day to day. You might imagine myself, I'm living in Queens. I've been in the US for a couple of years now, and I'm living in the cash economy. Say it's like 9 a.m. Saturday morning. I get a text from my friend or WhatsApp from my friend, and they're talking to me about this Komoon account. I'm in my apartment. I've got my wallet with me. So I download the app and I sign up online. I go through application flow. 5 minutes in, it's 9:05. Now I have a bank account. I've been auto-approved because I can do my geolocation application in the apartment. I can scan my ID, do the selfie. I am who I claim to be, and now I've got my account. It's 9:05. I go downstairs, walk across the street to 7-Eleven, and I've got like my previous cash accumulated from my shifts this week. Let's call it like I've got $500 in cash that I want to deposit. I go up to the cashier. I scan a barcode in the Komoon app, hand them cash. That's now in my account. We have this for, you know, all typical convenience stores in the US. It's like, what, 9:10 now, and I have my $500 cash in my Komoon account. Now I want to send money back home. So the example that comes to mind is like in Mexico, there's a convenience store called OXXO that's pretty much everywhere. It's like 7-Eleven in the US. If I have someone back home I want to send money to at an OXXO, I can then do that transaction in the Komoon app. Since it's this month, it's going to be 99 cents. That goes to them. They've received the cash in the local currency, same 5 minute period. So let's call it like 9:15. I've gone from unbanked, sitting on my couch. I drank my coffee. It's now 9:15 and I've sent money back home. I've got a bank account. I'm transitioning out of the cash economy. It's pretty sweet what we built so far. And we've been at this for, I think we're like 2 years since launch.
That's a lot of progress.
Yeah, it's amazing. And I think what's exciting about this space is you basically like build the surface area and then, you know, the world's your oyster, right? Like there's a million different directions we could go. We have a really good team who's really good at prioritizing, but, you know, in a long enough time period, you're building just amazing products to help transition these people across what upwards mobility, social mobility looks like for them and their family. The last piece I'll talk to you too is something that right now I'm interviewing a lot of people, so my whole spiel is pretty tight and tied in. But I think the piece that's most meaningful is that we really do serve like a very noble user. We're talking about people who have gone through a really hard experience to come here. And it's not like it's super easy when you get here. You're working super hard. But the motivation for them is to improve their families, wives, and their own together. That's a highly motivated person. And I use this term noble user because if you think about like, hey, I'm joining an early stage company, I'm going to be working hard. You want to be doing that for someone who you think is ethically motivated, right? That can be really meaningful for you if you're like, I often will commute to the office and, you know, we're doing things that are hard. We might be working a lot, but I might encounter on my commute, you know, 50 plus people who could be a target user for us who have much more challenging professional lives than myself. So that can be, for me, a strong motivator.
Yeah. I will just say, like, I think you're one of the engineering leaders that I've spoken to that has the best connection with the product. You fully understand the way you described the user experience. I mean, it's very complex. There's like physical dependencies. Someone literally has to get off their couch and go to a convenience store. But like, you know the user experience inside and out. And I can imagine that helps you when you're thinking and working with your team on, okay, how do you actually build this product and make it a reality? If you can picture it so viscerally in your head, that makes you better at building the product. So I'm curious, like, what is your current role as an engineering manager? Like, what is your team like? How do you guys kind of translate that vision that you just painted into like the tactical everyday of, you know, releases every week, web versus mobile? I'd love to hear a little bit more about that.
Yeah, there's a lot of cool stuff that we do here. I'll start with the first question. It's only actually very recent, but I transitioned into like, you know, official management. But I've been on our mobile team doing a little full stack stuff, but primarily on like our front end mobile team for quite a while now. I think what I've been telling folks is like, I had the easiest transition into management of anyone because I have like a rock star team. So it's been very low effort to have to do much at all. I mostly just had to get out of people's way, which is easy. Our team is, I think the things that distinguish us is the emphasis we place on being like product minded and really understanding this business. And maybe that's why, you know, I feel comparatively like I have, I appreciate the compliment. I hope I do come across as understanding what we're doing, because it is a piece that we try to emphasize in our hiring. There's like a million really solid engineers out in this world. I mean, no, there's actually far more, but there's a lot, so to speak. I think what we've historically found important is that we hire people with really strong fundamentals, like rockstar engineers, but that also appreciate, understand, and are curious about the business priorities too. That typically puts us in a place where we can maintain like a really flat team where folks have a lot of say over what they're working on. So what I tell people is a lot of the engineers here, I think, could be product managers elsewhere with relative ease. And then we have a really lean product team, but they're, you know, top class, like obscenely rich understanding of our users. They're kind of like walking around notions, like human notions, like the knowledge base website. Like they literally know every single fact and can regurgitate it. They're amazing. And then our team operationally tries to stay really startup-y. Like right now we're working in hexes for planning. So it's like the 6-week period. I think Basecamp was like one of the first teams to start talking about that in kind of high public view. It works well for us. So we eat up like 2-week periods of work that are composed into larger like 6-week periods, where usually in those 6 weeks you have like a project you're trying to ship. People operate in kind of independent pods, working on those from like 1 to 10 people, typically like pretty full stack. And then those 6-week periods are essentially derived from like a quarterly planning. So we'll plan like a quarter at a time. We really do like two. So like each quarter we plan for the immediate proximity 3 months and then the latter 4 to 6. And like the fidelity of those two can obviously, you'll get like a crisper image of the approximate 12 weeks rather than the following. But then when you repeat that process every 3 months, you get a pretty good idea of like, okay, these are the things we should anticipate. There's going to be some delta, but it helps you bake in a lot of the requirements early on. So that's worked well for us for planning. Hiring people that are able to work in that environment is important to us. I think it's that can be counterintuitive, is like somebody could be a top class engineer in terms of technical skills, but if it's hard for them to like understand the why behind what they're building, I think they could be challenged to work on our team. So that's like the kind of fluffy strategic hand wavy stuff. What it looks like on mobile team for releases is pretty interesting. Our team's really lean. So we've tried a few different things around testing over the past couple of years. I think what's been consistent across the board has been having rigorous like visual regression testing and unit testing, of course, always makes sense. Like those things being easily executable, doing that at CI time. So like anything going to main goes through those. I find that to be like a good starting point. We obviously have all the basic static tests in place too. Like for anyone listening, we're a React Native app, you know, cross-platform, we're built on Expo. I've talked to a lot of teams that are like, they don't use TypeScript. And then you like listen to podcasts and people are talking about like, oh yeah, like we're 20% of the way into our TypeScript migration. And that's just like insane to me. Obviously, we started from scratch using TypeScript, so it hasn't been a concern, but terrifying to me that so much of this world is built without types. So for releasing, what we've probably had the most changes on along the way has been like, how do you tackle QA end-to-end tests? And, you know, we've evaluated Maestro, we've evaluated tools built on top of it, all under the sun. So like kind of more managed things like AI-based stuff in the cloud, all kinds of stuff. Like we've done a ton of manual QA in the past. Like none of these things up until our relationship with you guys have been like the answer. Like it's been, you know, painful to, I think I probably manually QA'd our app like 60 times. We try to do like a weekly release, find that cadence to be helpful. And then for us, like, you know, thinking about our product, I don't think it's too hard to grasp that like a lot of what we're doing is integrating with partners, right? And I think like for, if you think about fintech in terms of decades, like the one that precedes ours is like, hey, let's take all these experiences and make them available as an API. Consumer fintech, why don't you guys go off and like start stitching those things together? That's why like in 2021, during like the highest hype period, you would see like banking for corgi owners and like insane variations. But for us in our present state, we manage all these integrations yourself, right? So like having robust end-to-end tests that are going to run on each release is like pretty critical. There's a lot of pieces of that set of integrations that if they break, I personally will have a terrible day, right? So when we do a release, we want to test those. A lot of them have like physical requirements, like using the camera, going through this whole process. Geolocation is another piece we use. So a lot of different variations explored. And I think what we've enjoyed with Mobot so far is like we can pretty much not think about any of that. In our current setup with you all, like I actually forget about you sometimes. And then just like when I come back to like we're setting up an automated sequence. So like have a cron job that's going to like run overnight, build it, goes to y'all. When I come on like say a Thursday or something, like, oh, everything's tested, good to go. I'll submit. And I just like quickly see the green check marks from you guys, whereas the process previously would take quite a while. So what we like to have is like this baseline suite of tests that's like always going to execute. I think what's important is it just like lowers this like manual burden of thought for your team and like effort. I've talked to so many people about this and like so many teams in the city, and it's kind of crazy how many different variations there are. Like I've talked to teams where it's like, okay, they'll say like, we do a release every 2 weeks, the whole team QA is the whole app. So like they have base test cases and then they test everything new and people test each other's crap. Like maybe there's like a psychology around that where if you're doing this rigorous testing, everybody gets a good understanding and they like know the product well, but it's pretty like high effort, right? And like if you're doing those base test cases, it's like how much benefit are you getting from going through like one critical flow 100 times in a 2 year period? Probably not too much. Yep. So
it doesn't scale well. And I feel like people are going to cut corners. They're like, I did this last week. It's probably fine.
Yep.
I mean, I'm guilty of that.
And I would assume you're pretty high on the ethics and trust spectrum. But I've had that experience. Like, I think I mentioned to you, like, we're pretty nomadic. And there was a period of time where we were living in, like, Tahoe and, like, kind of SF, kind of Tahoe, kind of SF. And, like, we would be driving to San Francisco. That's, like, a three-hour drive where you're, like, pretty much completely offline. I remember once I was, like, getting in the car and I saw something come up in, like, QA, like, evaluating a new release. I was like, wait, why is this not working? And you go to like the manual process and somebody like checked it off that they tested it. And it was like immediately clear that they didn't, right? And then I'm like getting into the car for 3 hours where there's like literally nothing I can do about this except just like be frustrated.
Yeah.
So yeah, that happens. I've come to think too, like I used to be a little too gritty and like hardo about this kind of thing. Cause like I had done the manual QA like 50 times and I, you know, I come to think of it as like, oh, I know I can do that in like 10 hours and minutes. And like, that's not that much time. So like other people have, you know, that was just a terrible mentality. I think what I've started to shift my thinking to is like, what's going to eat up energy and focus from the team? And like, let's optimize for that. Cause like, if we have good engineers, they cost money, right? So like, we're going to be paying them to spend their time doing something that is like no carryover into the rest of their experience and talents. Makes a lot more sense for us to externalize that to y'all. You're specialized for it. You have your cool robots in the Chrysler building. I mean, that's like insane. That's like kind of a really funny visual too. But that's worked really well for us. And I think overall, it's like, how much can we externalize that's going to be a distraction so we can like expend team focus and energy on critical things? Because even if you just like, say it was a short period of time, just like balancing that in your head is going to make you perform, you know, less effectively on everything else. We had like a talk with the Nubank CTO, Vitor. Nubank, for listeners who don't know, that's like a $50 billion plus market cap bank in Brazil. Gave a talk at Komoon, which was interesting. And one piece he mentioned that I think was kind of stuck in my head was this, essentially this analogy of like, if you have a really fast car, nobody's going to drive it fast if you don't trust the brakes, right? So like you can compile this team of really effective engineers who can contribute really quickly, but if they're in some way anxious that like something fundamental in the app could break and won't be tested, they're going to hesitate a little bit. That's an analogy I've been using around our team that I think it's like the first time I've heard that verbalized, like vocalized that way.
I love that.
It's a cool analogy.
I think for you guys, like your app experience, like I know for different teams, there's also like the prioritization of like, how much do you invest in this? You know, picking the right tool, picking the right process. But in your case, there's like such a huge level of business criticality and complexity. You mentioned it's all these SDKs that you're implementing and APIs you're implementing. There's like, yeah, the physical check deposit and the QR code scanning or barcode scanning at the convenience store. There's like price and location stuff and complexity around that, given you physically have to kind of leave your house. And so this isn't something that like would just work in a web app. I'm curious, like, as you're thinking about, you know, and this kind of goes back to just like the end user, the product experience, like, how do you gather that feedback from your end users? Like, are you watching them go to a convenience store and seeing how they use it? How do you guys learn from your users when you're deciding on new features and kind of making sure that everything works correctly and then making sure it all lines back up when engineering implements it and then you test it and QA it?
That's it. It's a really good question. I think it is one piece too that distinguishes us more on the product and design side too, is like the vast majority of our team is Spanish speaking from LATAM and now living in the US. Typically, like a lot of people that came here for school. We have a few like Americans and Europeans too, who like lived in Mexico, say, for like several years before coming to Komoon. So we have a population that fits the bill. Our founders are both from Mexico, came to the US for university. That's a really good starting point too. Like just like Spanish speaking as a important quality as somebody like interviewing customers obviously makes a lot of sense. But if you don't like think about it firsthand, like you could, you know, find yourself not thinking that that's an important requirement. I'm probably one of the worst Spanish speakers at Komoon, but we have a team that already like understands this population because they, you know, have the same characteristics themselves. But then we also build in a ton of different mechanisms by which to be constantly iterating, have a deep understanding. I mean, this week, like I can go and find this schedule where I can see exactly how many customer interviews are happening and like the subject matter that those are focused on. That's always been an important piece to us. The things we work on here like aren't that hard to think of. Like I think if you put anyone in a room and you're like, oh, we're building banking for a population, what do you think we should build? The selection of things, like enumerating what makes sense isn't too challenging. What I think becomes harder and like why we invest in having really good product thinkers is sequencing that appropriately. The prioritization is obviously, I mean, I'm not saying anything that's rocket science here. Like people that can prioritize a big set of things effectively are effective. We lean a lot on customer interviews. We lean a lot on like larger understandings of the ecosystem we're in overall. I think one thing that's been meaningful for us too is like our product doesn't have any subscription fee, right? So we're always then building for what's like the best solution in the long term, because like our incentives are built such that we want to make something that for which the unit economics are really affordable. And that's totally in line with our users, right? Like if they want to send money back home because we don't charge any sort of like, you know, higher subscription fee, we're totally incentivized to build what is the best and cheapest rails. I have like a silly framework for all of this that I've been talking to people about is like, if you think about fintech and try to simplify it, really consumer fintech, and try to simplify it pretty aggressively, it's like the parts of physics that are like pre-relativity. Like, you know, there's objects in motion and then there's objects at rest. You just have like money in motion and money at rest. And the analogies all apply to both. Like if you have money at rest, you don't want there to be entropy. You just want it to be stable, accessible, like low risk of being hit by inflation or any other mechanism that'll decrease its value. And if you're sending money in motion, you just want to have it be like frictionless, easy to do, low activation energy. It's the same analogy. So like, that's pretty much like all you're doing in consumer fintech at any given time. You're moving money, enabling new money movement, or you're enabling a better experience with money at rest. The sequencing of that is pretty hard. I think it requires being really at the pulse of what your users need and understand, and then also having a really good understanding of what the ecosystem is supporting at any given time. Because people are constantly iterating. There's always like some new API that can move money in some fanciful way on some crazy stablecoin thing that no one's ever thought of. There's like five of those a week. Like if you go on Twitter, you'll be overwhelmed with all of the capabilities. So being able to parse out like who's actually going to be a good partner, that's pretty critical. Understanding what the capabilities are out there, that's pretty critical. And the hardest part is, of course, staying close enough to your users that you know what it is that they need most. Our team's really good at that. I won't pretend that I'm like an effective part of that puzzle. Our product team, our design team is amazing. Our customer experience team, amazing too. And they're really effective at taking, you know, surveys, user interviews, and user feedback through customer support chat and translating that into our roadmap, our sequence of priorities.
Mm-hmm. I guess like in the early days, you mentioned you guys made the decision to use React Native. You know, everything's in TypeScript, so you didn't have to worry about migrating it later. And those kind of fundamental decisions to build the product, how is that informed by your understanding of like the demographics of your users being, is it predominantly iOS versus Android? Are they, you know, using the flagship, newest, latest and greatest devices, or are they using like older, laggier phones with smaller screens? How did you kind of like make some of those engineering and architectural and performance decisions? You know, because I've definitely seen sort of mixed feedback on whether React Native is good when you're doing lots of third-party stuff or camera stuff or native features that you need access to. Like, how did your team kind of weigh the pros and cons of all of those things? And then factoring in like just what's realistic, like what your users have in their pocket?
It's a really good question. I have every April 1st, I come in and I start talking about like the Samsung smart fridge app that we should be building. So like I tend to like throw in a joke, oh, like it's time to support Samsung smart fridge. Like let's go to iPad. Guys, it's time for Amazon Kindle. But no, like React Native, pretty high leverage for us from the get-go. You'd be surprised by how many of our users are actually not Android. Obviously like Android is pretty predominant, but there are quite a few iOS too. That, as you alluded to, the spectrum of device capabilities that they might have, it's pretty broad. So like I have a big, I call them my like flock of sheep of Android devices in office that are all kinds of different dollar figures to buy. I bought plenty from Walmart where I lie about saying that I'm going to get a phone plan because like you can't buy these like $50 phones without committing to a phone plan. And I'm just like, yeah, I'm going to get one tomorrow. I'm not leaving and never come back. So we try to do it ourselves of like being able to test in-house QA against all of these things. You guys have been helpful in that like I can start to think less about that. I think one thing we're going to explore with y'all is doing a kind of like a broader array of Android device testing. But I think like the simple heuristic for us is like you don't want someone to not get access to your banking product because their phone doesn't support it. And at the same time, it's like we're talking about a population for which our banking bundle is getting them out of the cash economy and into the digital economy. They probably don't care deeply about like amazing animations or really cool like haptic feedback. Like we'll build those things, but like the first and most important responsibility is helping them make that transition. Those are important guiding lenses. I think overall, it's really great that we started the time we did. If you look at the ecosystem we build in on a longer time horizon, I think what we've built wouldn't have been possible in the like pre-Expo era or before Expo became what it is today. And like we'll go to their office hours. It's still like an insane altruistic thing. Well, it's not altruistic purely, but like what they've done for our spaces, unbelievable. Like you can go to office hours on their Discord and like ask these people questions. They built like every capability possible, and I don't think they have any intention of slowing down. I don't think we would have maybe pursued the cross-platform React Native piece as aggressively before that was the case. we do have people that, you know, sometimes opine on like, hey, I've heard elsewhere, like they build native first because of like X or Y capability. It's very rare that that capability can't be surfaced somewhere in our setup, whether it's by a bridge or through exposed capabilities for like native API development. But, you know, maybe there are things that if I was building like some sort of like smart home app or something with like, or like a recording, maybe podcast experience at home for iOS, I probably would make potentially consider different directional decisions. But at the same time, it's like really nice to be able to hire people from the React ecosystem and like help transition them into React Native. I think that's like a capability you want to have in house, or you want to have as an option with whatever platform you choose. I don't know how easy it would be to go around and like have two teams of like independent iOS and Android engineers. When you look at like bigger companies, there's always this like weird thing of like they have like a poor performing quarter, and then they like, if they're a cross-platform app, they'll like fire like the Android engineers and iOS, and they had like N, and now they get like N divided by two, like of like a React Native team. That's typically like an anti kind of counter signal for success. But you see big companies do that. And maybe in theory, we, you know, by building cross-platform can maintain a smaller team. I think that there's probably reason to suspect that's potentially true. But yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, it's just like, what is your team comfortable with? What's the best approach for what you're building? And then just like being honest about the requirements that are more important to you.
And so you need access to the Komoon mobile app for sending money, but does the recipient of the funds also need the Komoon, like I guess the recipient in Latin America, like what's their mobile experience like in receiving funds?
It's pretty cool. We use WhatsApp pretty heavily, actually. Like that's a platform that's really popular with that population. They don't need a Komoon app. Though there are kind of like interesting pieces of that, right? Like if this is someone who might come to the US eventually, could be interesting to introduce the product at that point. Right now, our banking bundles available in the US. Who knows what the future holds, right? It could be something that could exist in other places as well at a certain point in time. But yeah, so far, that recipient doesn't need the app themselves. Their experience is primarily driven in WhatsApp.
And I guess in terms of your role, now that you're transitioning more into a management role, how much code do you still get to write? And what do you kind of see as your ideal vision for the team and also for the whole company going into 2025?
That's a great question. I think we're going to have a really big year. I think we've also tried to invest in things that'll make that growth easier, both in terms of team and total volume of what the app starts serving. For me, my day-to-day hasn't changed too much. You know, I've been doing primarily mobile for the time I've been here. Started doing more full stack stuff in the last like 9 to 12 months, more or less. What's changed very recently is adding the responsibility of just like ensuring that folks are, you know, unlocked, building into their future career interests, having a good understanding of what people are working on and why it matters. I still get as many commits in as I can, especially on a lean team. Like it's important to maintain proximity. I'm also like pretty early in my career too. So I think it's easy for people's egos to get super inflated, start making bad decisions, or just get like too distant from the development. Try to avoid any of those mistakes. We'll see what other ones I make. But hopefully I keep those in check. For myself, like what I've started telling people at Komoon is like I'm a shareholder first and an employee second. So like really whatever I can do that's most valuable to the team, that's been my kind of mental model for the time I've been here. And I'll probably try to stick to that. I think what's actually exciting about early stage is that it's a very rare circumstance that people can be incentivized to care more about the team overall than their individual outcomes. If your, you know, long-term compensation capabilities are primarily equity driven in your early stage, be a lot better to have the company succeed and you do some role that you're not super stoked about. If it means that the company's going to succeed overall, you're probably not going to complain, as opposed to the counter of like, you know, company hits some sort of asymptote, but you get to do whatever great role that you think excites you. That's a pretty special circumstance for us to be in. And like the investment teams that back us will like come in sometimes and talk to us, and they'll say things like, hey, you should like really savor this moment and like enjoy this stage because it's going to change dramatically in the coming months. When people say that, you're like, okay, yeah, got it. But then when you look back, it's like super correct and super meaningful. We've really increased our team size a lot in the last few months, in the last year. And a lot of things that like formerly were problems become a complete afterthought. And a bunch of new problems emerge, but things change pretty quick. I try to enjoy the day-to-day. We have really big ambitions for the upcoming year. And I would bet on us 100 times out of 100. So I think we're going to hit them. We'll see what evolves for me. We'll see what evolves for the team. I think the things that have gotten us here on the fundamental level stay important, like hiring people who have, you know, good foundations, but then also critically, like, care deeply about what they're working on as much as possible, can keep their egos in check and, like, progressively work on that. And then, you know, are willing to change their mind when, like, seeing new information, I think, is a piece that's been important too.
It's been awesome just seeing how much the product has evolved over the last few months that we've been working with you. And yeah, really looking forward to seeing how things continue to grow with the new features you're going to add. You know, I think it's all the enhancements to the user experience. Like, we're along for the ride with you guys. And it's, yeah, we're very excited. Is there anything else that you would want our audience to know about you or Komoon or anything that you'd like to share before we wrap?
We're always hiring. If you or someone you know is deeply interested in this problem set, send us an email. We love talking to people who care about this too. And our team is composed of people with all sorts of backgrounds. There's, I think fundamentally, if you care about this problem and you're willing to dedicate time and effort to it, your background doesn't matter as much. We'll find a place for you.
And what is your website if people want to check you out?
We are komoon.app, komoon.app.
Thank you so much, Devin, for taking the time to share your experiences, your backstory. It's always awesome getting a chance to talk to a founding engineer who's actually been along for the ride for a startup since, you know, very close to the beginning. I think you have a very special perspective and like a lot deeper of a connection to the product, the user experience, and it definitely shows in how you speak about the company and how you're leading your team. And yeah, very much appreciate your perspective and unique insights.
Likewise, it's been a pleasure.
That's all we have time for today. If you're interested in being a guest on the show, or if you'd like to suggest a topic, find us on Twitter at Team Mobot. That's TEAMMOBOT. This show is brought to you by Heavybit, the leading investor in developer-first startups. To learn more about Heavybit, visit heavybit.com.